The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am live from a very cold New York City today. For those of you who are on the Celsius scale, we are expecting in New York with wind chill to be minus 20 over the next couple of days, so with snow. So that's pretty cold for us New Yorkers. We're a hardy bunch in New York, but still that's pretty cold. So listen, just some quick news for the week. I don't like to say I told you so, but I will. HSBC is announced they're closing 1,000 more branches, that's four branches a week that they're closing. Well, high street banks have closed more than 1,000 branches in the UK in the past 2 years, but HSBC right now, 57 more will be axed in the first few weeks of 2017. We also saw UniCredit announcing reduction in force of 14,000 staff, which they blamed on the shift to digital. Now, we've been talking about this since, I've been talking about it since 2008. And I still, there's still people who still don't get this and still arguing over whether fintech is, changing the world. When you look at what's happening in China, 75% of mobile payments in China are dominated by two tech companies right now, Ant Financial, Alipay, and Tencent's WeChat. And if you can't see the shift that's occurring away from physical distribution to digital, then I don't know how else to explain it to you. I just don't know how else to do that. So in terms of some of the other news that's out there, blockchain getting a bit of traction. Surely with what's happening with Swift right now, blockchain has the potential to really be a big game changer there. Good news for Ripple and R3. But Citi has just backed their first blockchain startup, a startup called Cobalt, a blockchain startup aiming to bring distributed ledger technology to foreign exchange. But the one thing that I like to see in some of the research was there was a new research from law firm Paul Hastings, well known for economic and legal research. They said mobile and contactless payments means that by 2026 in the United States, cash will account for less than a quarter of U.S. Transactions. So again, we've known this been coming for a while, but I think actually China is probably going to go cashless before the US based on the way mobile's going there. So that could be very, very interesting. Anyway, a bunch of other news. The schemes for sandboxing continue to grow. We see Australia, ASIC, has launched a license exemption scheme for fintechs. We see the United Arab Emirates announcing a sandbox this week. Of course, this has added to a bunch of others who are doing this. I was in Finland a couple of weeks ago at Slush, and the Finnish and Norwegian regulators are talking about sandboxes. So this thought that there would be an equal playing field or level playing field for fintechs, it appears exactly the opposite's happening right now, that we're starting to give them allowances. Because ultimately, economies need to be efficient. And startups and fintechs are much more efficient at converting capital to innovations than the incumbents. I make that statement. If you believe that statement is wrong, I'm happy to talk to you guys about that. Now, we have coming up on the show today a huge show. We have Keith Teer. He is the founder of CEO and founder of Just.me, TechCrunch, Archimedes Labs, and now Accelerated Digital Ventures. We're going to be talking to him in a moment. Hopefully, we'll hear from Penny Crossman as well. She's going to join us. She's running a little late, so hopefully she'll make it into the show. But just before we get into speaking with Keith, just a couple of quick announcements. We've got Next Money coming up with the FinTech Finals in Hong Kong on January 18th and 19th. It is Asia's biggest fintech showcase. Several of the Breaking Bank's hosts are going to be there. Myself, Rob Finlay, JP Nichols, our regular guest on the show, Jim Morris, is going to be there as well. So, yeah, see if you can get down to Hong Kong. That time of year, it's the weather's great, and it's going to be very interesting. You can check out the event at ff17.nextmoney.org or just go to nextmoney.org, and it's part of the Start Me Up HK Festival. Now, also in March, I'll be at the Temenos Innovation Jam in Miami, and we, of course, want to thank Temenos for their continued sponsorship of the show. But if you go to temenos.com and look at events down the bottom of the page, you'll find the Innovation Jam there. So, all right, well, let's get into to chatting to Keith. Keith Teer, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, Keith, you know, you're right in the middle of it over there in Palo Alto and Silicon Valley. Whereabouts do you live in?
I live right in Palo Alto. Palo Alto's got a bunch of sub districts. The one I live in is called Barron Park, which is close to Stanford University.
Very nice area. Yeah. Now, you know, we had a bit of an event this week with a group of founders from Silicon Valley and leaders from the technology space come and meet Donald Trump and talk about that. What did you think of that whole spectacle? It struck me as a little unusual, but you know, what's the feel in terms of from the Valley in terms of what's going on with engaging between Trump and the Silicon Valley guys?
Well, I think at the outset you've got to say it's an extremely uncomfortable philosophical meeting, because Silicon Valley is, in essence, globalist. Silicon Valley benefits from and evokes globalization. It seeks to build companies that dominate markets well beyond the USA and to disrupt those markets. Donald Trump represents many things, but one of the things he represents is economic nationalism, preserving the US share of world trade at all costs. And that in a context where US GDP as a share of world GDP has been shrinking for the best part of 35 years. So economic nationalism usually arises in loser economies. And Silicon Valley, in a way, is a winner economy. It benefits from globalization. So I think Trump trying to recruit U.S. companies to help the U.S. economy will work with some companies, but in Silicon Valley, it's self-defeating. When you consider that Facebook, measured by population, is bigger than China, being narrowly American doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it's an awkward set of goals. And probably irreconcilable goals. It's very unlikely that, it would be very hard for, let's say, Amazon to be critical of Alibaba for stealing American jobs when Amazon is stealing jobs all over the world. Technology steals jobs. That's what it does. That's why it's good.
We've talked often about this on the show, the fact that, you look at an average Silicon Valley, company, mature company, a growth company, and they return, something like $500,000 in net earnings or profit per employee per year. They're very efficient at producing return. Whereas if you look at the financial services industry, where we speak, to them a lot, in their best years, they sort of do 60, 70, 80,000 net profit per employee. So technology companies are significantly more efficient at converting, capital into profits and innovations.
And that's going to happen more and more. I mean, if you just take an example like Travis Kalanick was at that meeting. Yeah. If Travis has his way with self-driving cars, he had a little speed bump yesterday in San Francisco.
Yeah.
The joke there is that the Uber driver went through the red light and then swerved to move into a Lyft car, was actually running an algorithm called Travis. In other words, it's entirely consistent with his personality to do those things on purpose. but if Travis has his way, we are going to be buying a lot less cars in future. There's going to be a lot less workers building cars, a lot less workers driving cars, and therefore, period, a lot less workers.
Yeah,
and that would represent success because it frees human labor from tasks that are no longer needed to do other things.
Increases GDP, increases the stock market performs better, but it's an antithesis to the jobs platform that Trump ran on, right?
Correct. It's exactly the opposite. So it seems as if the meeting must have been extremely superficial, a bit of a rah-rah meeting, where Trump basically said, we're going to lower taxes and let you bring back overseas piles of money cheaply. Yeah. And the tech companies said, great. But the conversation at a deeper level about what innovation represents and how the American economy could start to grow its percentage of world GDP again probably was not even discussed.
And 20% of the attendees at that meeting were part of the Trump family.
I saw that.
Interesting. Penny Crossman's just come into the studio, everyone.
I'm so sorry I'm late.
It's okay, Penny. You missed the news, but is there anything that you wanted to cover off?
Well, I thought the most alarming thing this week was the Yahoo breach.
A billion
so already
users hacked.
The 500 million accounts breached in September was the biggest breach ever, and now this 1 billion is going to be the biggest breach ever. And it was interesting that they say they did it through forged cookies. So they didn't have to steal usernames and passwords. They could simply collect the cookies that were being used in these interactions, which, you know, and some financial institutions do use cookies. And I think there are still some small banks that allow the username and password to be stored in the browser, which is, you know, really dangerous.
Yeah.
And obviously the Amazon Go news was really interesting.
Yeah.
And the Fed rate hike, you know, was big in our world.
Yeah.
We don't think it'll mean a lot quite yet.
Everyone was ready for it, right?
Yeah. And the banks are awash in deposits, so they really don't have to raise their rates.
Right.
They're not really afraid that people are going to leave. So it's probably not going to change that much for a while, but it's still
good. Well, thanks for that quick update. So Keith, let's get back to a bit of your history. You were, along with Michael Arrington, you guys founded TechCrunch back in 2005. Is that correct?
That is correct. We actually founded an incubator called Archimedes Labs together.
Okay. TechCrunch came out of Archimedes Labs.
It did. It was one of two initial initiatives. We did a company called Edgio, which was sold to Naval Ravikant's Fast.com in 2007. And we did TechCrunch. And TechCrunch was not really intended to be a commercial project. It was Mike's blog for writing about the companies we were meeting at the incubator.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Because that was pretty early in the cycle for blogs, which was maybe why it did so well. You guys also recruited a couple of well-known names now, Chris Dixon and Kevin Rose. They came on fairly early, I understand.
Correct. But you know, the blog thing is worth talking about. Dave Weiner lives in New York. He's one of the guys who first popularized RSS.
Right.
And he had a company called weblogs.com. And actually, the first thing Mike and I did was to help him sell weblogs.com to VeriSign.
I see.
That's where the bootstrap capital came from for Archimedes Labs. Dave infected us with blogging. Actually, as early as 2002, when I was running a company called Real Names, and Mike worked for me there, we fell into a big fight with Microsoft, and Dave Weiner introduced me to blogging, and I blogged the whole fight with Microsoft in 2002. So we were very, very familiar with blogging.
How did that work out for you?
You know, I got a lot of emotional relief out of it. I was pretty angry at the time, and I remember it was very therapeutic to be able to sound off in public and publish secret documents that proved what bad people they were.
Yeah. Penny?
If you don't mind, I'm just going to throw in a question here, because I feel like we're hearing a lot about how journalism is going down the tubes, you know, between...
She's a journalist, by the way.
Yeah, so feel free. Trash, you know, the whole industry. But I don't know. What's your take? Do you feel like we really are in a tremendously downward
like a
cycle?
Phase shift in terms of the way people get the news? You know, news station we throw in there as well.
Well, the first thing I'd say is I'm a huge believer in journalism. I don't see how you can have democracy unless you can hold people accountable, and for that to be possible, you need people who are prepared to tell the truth as they see it, and not be bullied or threatened out of doing that. So I'm a huge believer in journalism. And I don't think journalism ever goes away unless democracy goes away. Mm. So now the business of journalism is a completely separate topic. It's evolved. It's been evolving rapidly. And it's really to do with the decline of print and classified advertising to support the printed publications at the same time that you've had the rise of digital and alerts and notifications in particular, where people become aware of news in completely different ways that are much, much harder to monetize. So I think what we're seeing is the need for journalism as a business to redefine, firstly, how big a pie it can possibly hope to own, and it's going to be smaller than it used to be. And then what kind of level of professionalism that can sustain, and what method professionals can devise to make a living whilst doing what they love. And Arrington, to be honest, and it was him, not me, I was his mentor and former employer and backer, but TechCrunch was very much his show. He pioneered a form of individual, what I would call insider observation. It really isn't journalism, because he was an insider and he had access, because he was an insider, to all kinds of people who would allow him to go on the record about what he was observing and thinking and seeing. So in some ways, it was even more powerful than detached journalism, but it also comes with a point of view, which often is thought of as a bias, because it's an insider point of view. It's privy to information that only an insider could have, and therefore inherently biased. That seems to me to be quite common now.
Yeah, certainly. The openness and availability of platforms for publishing has created a lot more ability to get your opinion out there, whether factual or not.
Now, TechCrunch, to be honest, has moved on. TechCrunch today is nothing like it was under Mike's rule. Under Mike's rule, TechCrunch was a mouthpiece with an opinion. When Arianna Huffington and TechCrunch both joined AOL, and Arianna became the boss and Mike was basically fired, that was part of a debate about fact-based journalism as opposed to...
Oh, really?
Opinion. Yeah. We really believed in opinion-based journalism, and that isn't to in any way undermine fact-based writing. That's still important, but they're not the same discipline or the same thing. So we liked the op-ed with an opinionated writer who is transparent about their opinions, with the option of other people who have different opinions to also be able to come and say their opinions. Now, that is not journalism narrowly defined, but it is highly readable and engaging for anyone who cares about a topic. Probably like your blog, your podcast. Yeah. This show is,
you know,
I was listening to you in the early part of what you were saying. You have an opinion, and the fact you have an opinion makes it interesting. If it was only fact-based, it would be way less interesting.
No, I think, you know, I certainly do have an opinion.
Makes sense?
Yeah, no, I get it. So, Penny, in terms of sort of this debate here, you know, about fact-based news and opinions and things like that, the waters are getting cloudy, certainly around the election. So from a journalist's perspective, how do we fix this?
That is such a great question. I mean, you know, I think, you know, American Banker is obviously part of the more older school form of journalism. We obviously believe in trying to be very fact-based and try to check our facts and, you know, be very, very careful about what we put out there. Sometimes there is opinion in there, but it just seems like there isn't really any way for readers to definitively know that what they're reading is fact-based versus fake or versus just not very accurate. And I wish there were some way that you could filter for people and make it clear to them, you know, this is just an opinion. This is fake. This is a little bit of each. You know, this is a truly verified, you know, authentic, credible piece of journalism from an accredited institution. But I don't know that there's any, it would be kind of nice if somebody could certify content that way, but it's hard to picture that happening.
So, you know, the thing around climate change is a good example of how things can become obfuscated by, you know, opinion. Some people clearly have an opinion that climate change is a hoax, but the scientific facts are clearly in favor of the fact that there is, you know, some fairly dramatic change going on in the environment, and that, you know, there's a very strong suggestion, you know, and statistical evidence to suggest that it's influenced or man-made, right? But some people have the opinion that that's not true. So how do you differentiate against something that's a scientific fact versus someone who's very passionate about their opinion but is factually wrong? Keith?
Well, I think the first thing is you must never say that something is a fact unless it's, you know, water boils at a certain temperature. You must never say something is a fact and then disallow any other point of view. The minute you do that, it's good, you know, it's good to say something's a fact, by the way. But if you, by so doing, disallow another point of view and call it fake, you basically become dictatorial in a way that China is or Russia was. So it feels to me as
who decides what's fake and not, right?
Who decides what's fake and not? And funnily enough, because Trump won the election, the left, who normally would be more democratic, are the ones trying to close down conversation to, quote, fact-based. And I actually think that's a bad trend, even though I despise fake news. Yep. I think we've got to find ways to expose fake news and distinguish fake news from opinions we disagree with.
Yeah.
They're not the same thing. And there's a blurry line there, and some people are associating the two as if they are the same thing. The fake news is something I disagree with. Climate change is a fairly good example because you're quite right that the predominant scientific opinion says that the world is warming up. A very large percentage of that says the cause of the world warming up is human beings. There is some minority scientific opinion that says the world is warming up, but it isn't to do with human beings. It's a normal cycle, and we just don't live long enough to have seen it before.
Right.
I have no clue who's right. Mm. I'm fascinated by the conversation. And my instinct is humans must have something to do with it, but may not be everything to do with it.
Sure.
Now, if you were trying within that to say what are the facts and what is the opinion, I think it's pretty hard to disentangle.
Yeah. Now, fair enough. Now, I did note that, you know, in terms of sort of the TechCrunch history, you know, there's very clearly this sort of startup, hereditary approach to this. You know, you've got Crunchbase, you've got TechCrunch Disrupt, which is where a lot of some really cool startups have launched. You've got the Crunchies, which are, you know, awards run by TechCrunch for startups. So it's, you know, TechCrunch seems to have held you know, onto that that sort of startup vision. And ultimately, that's what you're still doing, right? You've just launched the Accelerated Digital Ventures Fund, £150 million around that. So, you know, given that you've been in this space for, you know, a couple of decades now, it looks like, in terms of the startup space, you know, what's your general feel of how the whole startup space, venture capital, is going to go with the Trump presidency over the next 4 years?
Yeah, interesting. By the way, you're very gracious to say a couple of decades, because I did my first startups in the 80s, so it's more like four decades.
There you go.
Venture capital is itself, those two words have been in our dictionary for four decades or more, but actually the meaning of them has changed many, many times, and most recently in the period since 2008, when Yuri Milner came here with DST Capital and invested in Facebook at a valuation of $10 billion. He put in $100 million, and everyone thought he was nuts. Since that moment, venture capital has really changed. So the Valley today, if you really break it down, is three clusters of money, which look very different from the Valley that I came to in 1997. The three clusters are seed money, growth money, and venture money. And seed money is what most people focus on. It's roughly $5 billion of total assets in the asset class to be invested over about 3 to 4 years. Growth money is unlimited. It's hundreds of billions of dollars for people like Uber and Snapchat. Mm. And it's not coming from venture capital mostly, but some of it is. And in the middle, you've seen a tug of...
And big private equity firms. And yeah.
Correct. Fidelity recently and others. So in the middle, you've seen a rapid move away from the middle. So these days, you either have micro funds doing early stage deals, or you have growth funds doing late stage deals. In the middle, you've got what everyone calls the Series A or the Series B crunch.
Yeah.
Where there's almost no capital prepared to take risk prior to market proof for big long-term ideas. So my view of venture capital is it's fundamentally become short-termist or opportunist. Short-termist.
And as a startup founder, you've got to be prepared to get results really quickly or you just run out of funding.
Which means you've got to have small ideas because you can't get results quickly for big ideas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is fundamentally broken.
So it's going to be tougher to do an Uber or a Facebook today?
Uber's one of those that you could do because Uber didn't have to invent anything.
Right.
You know, there was already private hire cars. There were already smartphones and GPS. So it was a little bit of software could pull it together and you could create something that already existed but no one could see yet. Those things can still happen. But anything really fundamental that needs... I'd say more than a couple of million dollars and more than a year to get going, nobody will fund that today.
Yeah. Well, Keith, we're running out of time, unfortunately. It's a very fascinating discussion, but we have Brian Solis ready after the break to have a chat with and get into about his new book. So where can people follow you and keep up with what you're doing?
I am K-Tear on Twitter, K-T-E-A-R-E. You can follow me there or the same on Facebook and the same on Skype. So it's easy, K-T-E-A-R-E, my first letter of my first name and my last name. Accelerated Digital Ventures, by the way, is focused on that middle and trying to fix that broken ecosystem.
And where can entrepreneurs who have their own startups find out about ADV, Accelerated Digital Ventures?
Just go to accelerated.ventures. That's it, no.com, accelerated.ventures, and there's a place to send us stuff on the website there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for joining us on Breaking Banks Day. It was a very enlightening conversation. And just on behalf of the crowd of entrepreneurs, thank you for your support of things like TechCrunch because we spend so much time over there.
You're very welcome. Thanks
Great.
For having me.
No problem. That was Keith Tear. He, amongst other things, the founder, one of the founders of TechCrunch, and with his new, talking about his new fund, Accelerated Digital Ventures. So we're going to go to a quick break right now, guys. Thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks. If you want to check out some of the other episodes that are we've had in the past, just go to breakingbanks.com or check us out on iTunes. We'll be right back after this short break with Brian Solis.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick Award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, you are back with Breaking Banks. Don't forget that this is a conversation. You can tweet us out. The Twitter ID is at Brett King and at Breaking Banks 1. Penny, what's your Twitter ID? Yeah, Penny Crosman, right?
Oh yes, thank you for asking.
So you can tweet us out and ask us some questions. And joining us right now, one of our favorite authors, Brian Solis. Welcome to Breaking Banks.
Hello, hello. What a cool thing this is to happen. I'm well overdue.
It is. You know, we sort of we had this sort of digital courtship, didn't we? We interacted.
Did you
actually
leave or something?
No, it's fine.
I swiped right.
Yeah, you swiped right. and we sort of kept running into people we each knew, and then finally, just in Beirut of all places, we met just a few months ago, a couple of months ago actually, and keyed up having you on the show. And for those of you that don't know Brian, and I'm sure most of our audience will know Brian, we've talked about him before, but he's a prominent keynote speaker, he's a best-selling author. His latest book, X, The Experience When Business Meets Design, is a bestseller on Amazon and has done phenomenally well. He's also a principal analyst at Altimeter, a profit company. He's a digital anthropologist, he's a futurist, and like I say about futurists, being a futurist means never being wrong today. So, you like that one? Have you heard that one before, Brian?
Yes, that's pretty good.
Yeah, okay. So, tell us about how the book's going. I know you've had it out for a few months, but tell us about what led you to do this latest book.
Oh boy, well, it's the seventh book, and it was one that I was very passionate about, but it was also one that was very difficult to put together. The topic is experience design. And the word experience is one of those things that I think we all use, but I don't know that we've had time to reflect on what experience actually means. What the premise of the book is, I wanted to introduce the notion of the fact that experiences are real world emotions, right? We have an experience all day, every day. And a lot of those experiences, how people feel, how they react, they're just sort of left to chance, right? We think as companies, we think about products and services and touch points and journeys and marketing. But we don't think about the experience. We don't think about the experience at the brand level. Like, what is that supposed to feel like? And then once you think about that, so how would we design how we do business, how we design our products, how we market them and sell them and support them differently to sort of bring that experience to life? And the topic is incredibly ethereal, and the difficulty was trying to make it tangible. So it took about 3.5 years to put this baby together.
Now, you know, technology is creating a lot more experiences, right? Because it's surfacing utility around services and businesses in more real time. And you know, so it's no longer just simply a product or a service. The compelling piece of it is how frictionless and how, you know, well-designed that experience is. So this is sort of enabling this shift, the real-time mobile, and then in the future, voice and VR, AR world is really driving us towards more of an experience-driven distribution model, yeah?
Yes and no. I mean, the thing about experiences is that I like to think about them as reactions. And those reactions can and should be designed. You think about sort of what Tinder has done to the dating scene or what Uber has done to the rideshare scene. Those have changed.
This is the second time you mentioned Tinder, by the way.
Well, one quick thing on that is, if you think about it, let me drop this on you. Customer experience, right? It's one of the biggest trends in business right now. When we talk about customer experience, or when companies invest in technology to bring about better customer experiences like, I don't know, chatbots, artificial intelligence, virtual augmented reality, beacons, Internet of Things, you name it, whatever trend, you know, we could plug it into that. But very rarely do they take that perspective from the customer's POV, right? They just think that if we deploy these things, we are going to naturally bring about a better customer experience. Or especially with banks, if we create an app that's inherently mobile, we're going to give people a better customer experience. It is all well and done until you look at it from the customer's perspective. Is this what I expect based on how I live life? So banks, in many ways, compete against Uber in that there is an incredible user experience. It's incredibly frictionless. It's focused and simplified. A lot of the things in terms of transaction details are sort of behind the scenes. And now that sort of becomes the layer of expectation and preference that a human being has. And they look at every company in the world to expect the same thing.
Yeah. So it's like we sort of have these design patterns that are emerging based on best practice companies like Uber and others and saying, why can't my bank do that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then I think
here's one for you. You may not know this, but did you know that Uber is one of the top originators or acquirers of small business bank accounts in the United States?
I did not know.
I'll tell you why that is. A third of their drivers in cities like New York, a third of their drivers have never had a bank account. So what Uber had to do to enable them to drive for Uber, because they can't get paid in cash, is they have to have a debit card. So Uber did partnerships with banks like Green Dot and others to issue them with a debit card. And in doing so, became at the peak of this, became the third largest acquirer of small business bank accounts behind Wells and Chase.
Amazing how quickly
that
happened.
And they also do leases. They do car leases. Yep. So, you know, you could say, now, they don't want to be a bank, but they're doing banking experiences embedded into Uber to make sure their business works.
Maybe a little like Amazon lending to small businesses that market on its platform.
Alibaba as well. Yeah. So, you know, because of this experience-driven approach, are we starting to sort of see those typical definitions of, you know, businesses in terms of the silos sort of break down, Brian?
Well, I'd like to think that that's that's ultimately going to happen. The thing is that what most businesses lack is empathy, right? I mean, Uber, in your Uber example with banks, or in comparison to banks, I mean, Uber has two sets of customers. They have drivers and then they have passengers. And to bring those worlds together, they have to create an ecosystem. And to facilitate that, they have to not just think that they're a ride-sharing company, that they're a lifestyle company, and to help people sort of become their small businesses, to become entrepreneurs, and to also help passengers have a better experience, they have to design what that should be at an ecosystem level, right? Much like how Apple thinks about their products and services. So in that regard, you know, Uber has an advantage because it can invent as it goes. Traditional businesses or even banks, they have these silos for a reason. These are based on, you know, everything that you learn in management school, 50, 60-year-old models that are designed to be efficient, designed to scale, and designed to, you know, eliminate redundancies, give executives sort of an infrastructure of which they can manage. But that was yesterday, right? That was the consumerization of technology sort of changed all that. It's also changed behaviors and preferences and expectations and values. And what that means is now businesses are having to undergo what's called digital transformation as a way of just sort of competing for the new customer. And this becomes difficult because silos by design do not allow for taking risks, do not allow for rapid decision making, do not essentially allow these types of companies to compete against startups, which is where disruption starts to come into play.
Now, I'm very interested in this sort of continued experience development. I know Robert Scoble, who's been on the show many times. We're going to have him on next week, actually, talking about, actually, I think it might be in early Jan that we have him on the show, talking about his new book, The Fourth Transformation. But as part of this, he talks about the fact that, you know, these technologies are leading to new types of interactions through mixed reality. But the one that I'm really interested in is sort of the emergence of the smart assistant, or AI, and how that is being surfaced through voice with Alexa and Google Home and so forth. So how do you go about transforming your organization to capitalize on these new tools? It started with mobile app, you know, then we have wearables, but, you know, pretty soon the sort of smart assistant, the AI, the voice-led things, this is going to capture a lot of that experience real estate, you know?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm a big fan of Scoble. We've been friends for, gosh, I don't even, way too many years, and, you know, he's absolutely right, and you're absolutely right, and I think the challenge that companies have is they tend to look through a legacy lens when thinking about new technology. Of course, we should implement all of these new technologies and new products and services, but this is where experience design comes into play, and this is what sort of inspired me, is that you cannot take these new platforms, which are inherently disruptive, and stuff them into the old box or the old way of doing things and expect it to sort of transcend where you are to where you need to be. That's not how any of this works, and this is why companies like Uber come along and disrupt entire industries. It's because they have a new perspective. It's because they invent technology to do this particular thing, which in many cases are delivering a new type of experience as part of a problem solution and also as the creation of new opportunities based on what technology facilitates, not just what it enables. And that's where a lot of people get caught up. I don't think a lot of banks, I don't think a lot of these companies are going to survive in the long term. What they're riding on right now is the momentum that they have over these last few years and this sort of mentality that, you know, we're too big to fail. But at the same time, customers are changing. Every single day, they become a new sort of categorization where the products and services that we've thrust upon them and the ways that we've thrust upon them in terms of compromising and doing business, the way that they go through their customer journeys today, all of that is changing. They're starting to wake up and realize that they have choice. They're informed, they're empowered, they're connected. And this is what sets the stage for disruption, because a startup can realize this and take advantage of it faster than a big entity could. However, with that said, these new technologies, especially those that that Scoble talks about and Israel talk about in their book, the Fourth Transformation, with the right vision, with the right experience architecture, you could actually spin out, say, innovation centers from any of these big organizations to start to experiment, to start to basically compete in the startup ecosystem in ways that you couldn't in headquarters.
Yeah, and so it's not just adding on a channel for distribution now. You really do have to change the way you think about your customers. It's not this demographic approach anymore. It's behavioral and situational and contextual. And yeah, it's you know, we're talking about some pretty significant game changers here. So Penny, you had a question from
yeah, both. And I mean, just on that, a lot of banks have innovation labs and they have innovation centers and they have a head of digital banking, but it's hard. They still move slowly because of the nature of their matrix organizations, and it's kind of rare that they're just given free rein to move really quickly. But on the artificial intelligence chatbot, virtual assistant, I think that we're at a fascinating point right now because you have a number of companies that are starting to experiment with offering virtual assistants. You know, Barclays has one, and Bank of America has one that they've demoed, and they're going to roll out in a few months. And there's a couple of others, and Capital One, of course, but you also see companies that put digital virtual assistants out there and then they get mocked by customers in the press because, you know, even though artificial intelligence has been around for like 60 years, in this context, it's like a toddler. It's still young. Right. It still doesn't have the true understanding. It basically has the questions and answers that you feed it. And then you can try to teach it with voice interactions, but then you find voice interactions and text interactions are very different. So, I mean, I think it's a hard time if you're a financial institution to try something like that, put yourself out there, and then be subject to like ridicule and criticism for having something that doesn't really, you know, doesn't really answer questions in a sophisticated way, or doesn't answer the questions or doesn't understand a lot of the questions that it's given. Brian, what do you think? Is it worth it to just put yourself out there and start experimenting and start learning, or is it better to just keep it behind the curtain until it's like as close mature to perfect, yeah, mature or much more useful?
Should there be a culture of experimentation?
I love this question. I'll tell you why. I mean, Penny, earlier when you talked about how many banks have innovation centers, I just published literally yesterday a new report. It's the third in a series that studies innovation centers around the world, looking at every industry from manufacturing to finance to, you know, automotive. And I'll say that one thing that they all share is a lack of vision and a lack of imagination. And the reason I say that is because they're still bound to the traditional rules and governances of which sort of operate the entire organization operates around. So this is why you see some banks rolling out chatbots today, is because they just feel like, you know, technology is the innovation, but technology is part of the innovation solution. The real innovation is when you create new value. So if you're using a chatbot today to answer traditional questions in the absence of putting an agent in front of that, that is not innovation. That is iteration. That is doing these same things, and maybe it's better. You know, maybe it's more efficient. Innovation is unlocking new value. And only one of those two leads to a path of disruption, which is doing new things that make the old things obsolete. So the answer to your question is, absolutely, those should operate behind the curtain in a lab to not feed it questions and let it answer those questions. It's to solve problems and let machine learning or artificial intelligence start to understand and teach itself what those problems are and how to create new value in the process, even if that takes a little bit longer, because when it does launch, it does innovate. And that's where the industry starts to say, whoa, what just happened? Because typically the industry confuses innovation and iteration, where they're actually iterating, not innovating. And I know this sounds strange, but why this is important is when I tell you to think outside the box, all I'm doing is putting you in another box. I'm not changing the rules. I'm not changing the game. I'm not changing the metrics for success. I'm still imposing risk adversity upon you. I'm still imposing, you know, yesterday's standards of success upon you and all of the things that you do. This is why startups have had the advantage in this regard. It's because they're thinking about the things that most companies cannot, and that is just simply because of the management infrastructure of which they operate in. Even if it's in an innovation center, it's still operating against the same rules of the culture of the organization itself.
Now, are you a believer in the whole internal innovation lab thing? Do we see evidence that that works compared with the more rapid innovation that we have from startups? Startups, there's no question that startups deploy capital more efficiently, but you talk about digital transformation. For example, HSBC just announced, these big layoffs and branch closures in the UK, and they've really, really struggled with the whole digital thing. Can they really, is an innovation lab going to help them to bridge the gap and transform?
It could, but they have to operate against a different set of principles and goals and objectives, right? The number one challenge that these innovation centers have, as told by the people in the innovation center, is that they can't change what headquarters values fast enough.
Right.
So when you open an innovation center,
even though they can innovate, they hit this brick wall of process and compliance and...
Right. And so the answer to your question is that can they operate, especially in a regulatory environment, successfully? The answer is yes. There are cases that I've studied where they are allowed to operate as its own entity, and actually they're empowered to do so, but it really comes down to culture. Culture is the number one thing that prevents all innovation, in that if you are allowed to take chances and even rewarded for doing so, then you will get some really interesting results. Now, that comes with its own set of challenges as well, where the rest of the organization says, hey, what's going on over there? And why can't we be part of that? Why are we getting our jobs eliminated on this front when there is all kinds of money going in over here? So I think that the faster we can start to test and learn and implement and scale, the better it is for everyone else. Now, I do want to put something out there, though, that it's something I've studied. I haven't been too vocal about it because it's very controversial, and I'm trying to figure out how to couch this in the most productive manner, which is the biggest challenge that is unaddressed is the lack of expertise within an organization in even trying to learn and do new things. That there's a sort of great reluctance in actually taking chances in your own role or learning new things because you just want them to be the way that they are and then surprised when the company has to change.
Hmm. Now, when you're in this situation as, as an advisor to these big companies, They've got to ask you the question, what do we do next? So how do you get someone to start down this path?
Well, the one thing, I don't have all the answers. I don't pretend to have all the answers. If it's one thing that I've realized in the last 20-something years. I thought
they were the answers.
Well, what I do, here's just to give people context if they don't have any idea who I am. It's that I don't pretend to know everything. But I do the work. I've changed big companies. I've changed little companies. I've launched over 1,000 startups in the last 20 years. It is humbling to know that you're always learning something new. And when I write a book, I do not talk about case studies and best practices. I am trying to help break people from the shackles of legacy thinking to invent. And give them the tools that they need. And here's how we invented. And here's how you can do it too. But you have to do the hard work. And that's not the most popular Tony Robbins style message. But it is what works over the long term. And so what I tell a company to do is go backwards. What are you trying to do? What does the customer want? Where is the customer going? What do they value? What is happening outside of your industry in their world that they are putting their money behind, that they're putting their loyalty behind? And let's take those cues and find areas where we can eliminate friction, improve experiences, innovate, and prioritize that and put resources behind that. And then look at where we're spending other where we're putting our money and resources right now and start to decide what's the opportunity cost and what's our ROI opportunity if we just start shifting things around. But that takes leadership and not management, and that's where I have to go, is at the top to get people to see things differently.
Now listen, we've only got a few minutes left, Brian, so I wanted to ask you this. 2017, what's going to be the big news, the big the big technology led stuff or experience led stuff that you see happening next year? What are your top three or five?
It's going to be everything you're hearing about right now. You're going to start to see conversational commerce in the form of chatbots and messaging really start to mature. Basically, you know, we kind of joke and say that they're the fart apps of their equivalent right now. But in the next year, they're going to be pretty impressive, because you're going to have experienced architects like guys at Adaptive Path who are going to invent some pretty interesting things. You're going to see autonomous cars really start to blow your mind in how publicly tested they're going to be around the country. But I think for the most part, you're going to see a lot of the same. You're just going to see them mature over the next year. And then from there, 2018 is where we start to see some real interesting applications for virtual and augmented reality that are beyond the gaming and novelty items.
Yeah, it's gonna mature quickly. It's very, very exciting. So, how can people get in touch with you, Brian, or find out what you're doing in terms of speaking and so forth, new books?
Well, everybody, it would be a pleasure if you connected with me at Brian Solis, BrianSolis, basically on everything.
On everything. Yep. Facebook, Twitter, and your website, briansolis.com, of course. So thank you very much for joining us, Brian. It's always a pleasure, and hopefully we'll run into each other somewhere in 2017. Are you going to be at CES?
I'll see you at CES, and happy holidays to everybody listening.
We'll see you at CES with Scobalizer and get together there. Thank you very much for joining us on the show. Now, for you guys, a big shout-out to Temenos. Thank you to Penny Crosman for joining us in the studio this week. And don't forget, follow the show on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 and on Facebook at Breaking Banks Radio. And if you like the show, don't forget to go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps other people find the show. Also, check out Sam Moore's new podcast. He's one of the hosts for Breaking Banks. He spun off FinTech 5. You can check out FinTech 5 at fintech5.com or on iTunes, SoundCloud, and anywhere you listen to podcasts. That's it for this week. Thanks for being with us at Breaking Banks. We will see you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.